We are about to have a conversation with Katrina Vandenhoevel, who, of course, is the editor and publisher of The Nation. Joins us. It's been a while since she's been on the program with us, but it's good to have her back. Katrina, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we all have to ask this question first, given that, you know, that I saw your head-to-head with Bill Kristol on ABC's This Morning with George Stephanopoulos.
You saw it. Well, you know, the back history, the back story, Mark, was goes way back. Goes back to 2002, 2003, when The Nation, you know, along with other good people, understood what a disaster the Iraq War would be.
Right.
For the Iraqi people, for the region, for our security, for this country. The costs were clear even at that time. So, you know, we come to this moment, and what do we see again as this country might be pitched into a different kind of war in the region? We're getting counsel from the very people who took us into the greatest disaster of the 20th century. I mean, these, and people like Bill Kristol, who I sparred with, Dick Cheney, I mean, Doug Feith, Paul Wolfowitz. I mean, these were the architects of the Iraq War. And we're not hearing, once again, as was the case in 2003, we're not hearing enough from those who see the danger, who speak cogently, who have expertise in the region. We're hearing from the very architects who are trying to rewrite history as fast as they can to cover up their own devastating failures. So when I learned I would be on the program with Bill Kristol, we were also asked to think about, you know, Iraq and Syria, to talk about that. We got on the set, and, you know, about 30 seconds before we went live, George Stephanopoulos told us we'd be talking about Hillary Clinton and John Boehner and Mississippi. And I just felt it was very important, using Boehner and the kind of abdication of Congress's role on issues of war and peace, to raise issues of war and peace and find a way to raise what I feel very passionate about, which is accountability in our political and media system, and holding accountable those who come on so blithely today as armchair warriors and counsel us to get into another war. And I didn't mean to be glib. I had written a column for the Washington Post the week before this program in which I wrote, after walking very seriously through the cost of the war, more than $3 trillion, how many Iraqis have died, how many Americans, the veterans, the brain injuries, I did write that, you know, I will say that should members of the neoconservative movement feel so motivated, we would wholeheartedly respect their decision to enlist in the Iraqi army. So I, you know, it was in my mind, it was in my heart, and I also, with all humility, felt as wind at my back, the views of so many I've talked to in these last weeks who say, what's going on? Why are we hearing from these people again? Can't we hear, as I said earlier, from those who, you know, did not stump for the original Iraq invasion? So that was at the motivation. And I think it's important. I'd also say that, you know, we are part of, Mark, you're part of a, you know, radio show which brings on alternative intelligent voices. I hope The Nation tries to move the discussion and debate in interesting ways, understanding that too often we have a kind of downsized politics of limited alternatives, that if you have the possibility of going on a show like this week on ABC, to bring your views and not check your views at the door just because you're getting on a program like that. And I think I felt that too. And I think we all play a role, but we do need to drive the kind of inside the Beltway debate, which is, I have to say, pretty ossified, so that what we can do is push it and become a vital forum for debating what we stand for. And I think, and again said with humility, that there are millions of people out there, and I got a lot of emails, who, you know, are kind of shocked when they hear something like what I said on ABC, because they're used to a kind of constrained, limited parameter of discussion and debate. So that's where, you know, more seriously, that's what I was trying to do and touched a chord. And I think anyone who has the opportunity to go on these shows should really try to push this debate, not in a silly way, but in a way that I think is critical, because as you well know, you know, the larger issue is I don't believe there's a military crisis, military solution to the crisis in Iraq or the broader crisis in the region. And I think too often political folks inside Washington. And I, you know, the military is often a restraining force in interesting ways these days, but too often people like John McCain, who's the most frequent guest on Meet the Press,
mm-hmm.
you know, their idea of action is military action. And I think that's a very, it's wrongheaded, it's obsolete. The crises we face as a country and as a world often are not dealt with through military action. I mean, think of climate crisis, think of staggering global inequality, of pandemics, of nuclear proliferation. So I think there's a new mindset that is needed in addition to just challenging the day-to-day kind of discussion going on in establishment media.
One of the interesting conversations we had here recently about what's going on with Iraq, we had a number of guests here. One of the guests was Phyllis Bennis, who you know very well from the Institute for Policy Studies. And the other was a professor from Toronto who I've been interviewing for the last 14 years, who is Iraqi and was part of the resistance against Saddam and fled and also opposed the American incursion in the war that was started in Iraq. His name is Dr. Tapat Abdullah from Toronto, a brilliant guy who's also written a history of Iraq. And he and Phyllis got into an interesting discussion. And I'm just curious to see your take on this, because I think this is a kind of a divide in some ways of progressives of the left around the world about how to respond to this, at least seen from these Iraqi perspectives. Adil Shamu was part of that conversation as well here in the studio, who's at IPS as well. But at any rate, what Tapat said was that he agreed with everything Phyllis had said, but what makes him nervous about what the American progressives say is that, and I'll read a quote from what he said. He said, but America has a responsibility. They did get involved. I don't think it's even morally correct for a new administration to come in and say the previous administration messed up. Now I'm getting out. Now the region has to deal with it. And that his kind of nervousness hearing that America wants to back out and that he thinks that America has a responsibility towards the Iraq and the people who have tried to create a new nation there after this invasion, to just say, oh, we're not going to give any money, we're not going to give any arms, we have to back away. How do you respond to that?
I think that's a very important point. And he certainly speaks with moral, personal, political, historical authority. You know, part of the problem, I think there are false choices being made here, Mark. I think there's this idea that it's either do nothing or U.S. military intervention. My sense is what's needed is American diplomacy, engagement, not American bombs. But, yes, that may require resources, but not at the scale of what even military strikes or what we're providing Syrian rebels with. I think we should double down on the humanitarian crises in the region. You know, you saw this story last week that the world has not seen more displaced people, more refugees at any time since World War II. I mean, this is an extraordinary catastrophe, and that requires American and world engagement. So I'm not calling for isolationism, and I think too often progressives get labeled as isolationists if they don't take to the military position. But, you know, there's also been a discussion, and the magazine, our magazine has engaged it, about reparations. I mean, you know, this idea, there's the glibness of the Pottery Barn rule, remember? I mean, was it Colin Powell, you know, you break it, you own it. Well,
right.
There is, you know, again, it's not a military solution, but it may well be that we do owe the countries we've intervened in a measure of involvement in education, in food security, in infrastructure. Now, of course, people will say in this country, well, what about our infrastructure? Well, if we allocated our money more wisely, I do think there'd be resources. So I think he speaks, again, with a good point. And I think the progressive left does need to think hard about something beyond just a policy of non-intervention, anti-intervention. There have to be other, the wonky term, but other tools in the toolkit to engage with a world in crisis. And I think that we should step up to that. Again, I just come back, though. I don't think it's bombs. I think it's American diplomacy, regional diplomacy, political solutions. You know, one thing that has gone under the radar in some ways, Mark, is what I think is a very important template for nonproliferation efforts. It's gone under the radar for legitimate, understandable reasons because of the horrific humanitarian crisis in Syria. But the fact that we averted military strikes last August, and that the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons stepped in with collaboration Russia, the United States, Iran, Syria, and dismantled and destroyed chemical weapons in that country in the context of real crisis, I think is a template. And I think we need to look at that and understand it and not just dismiss it because of the humanitarian crisis.
I was really fascinated by the piece you just recently wrote on Obama should set his sights higher in the Washington Post. Because I've been following a lot of what you've written over the years, and the progressives have had a difficult time sometimes wrestling with issues around the Obama administration, and also, but not so difficult when it comes to the direct issues of dysfunctional Washington and Capitol Hill. So let's talk a bit about your assessment of that, of your assessment of the dysfunctional nature of what's happening in Capitol Hill from the Republican side, but also kind of in some ways the inertia of the liberal Democratic Party in terms of what they're doing.
So beginning with the dysfunction, I mean, Republican obstruction is so extreme now that it's just, you know, brazen, right? I mean, but one can't forget that Senator DeMint, Senator McConnell, announced hours after President Obama was, I think, inaugurated, that their first order of business was to ensure that nothing get done, that he not accrue any benefit through action. You have to wonder why some of these Republicans want to be in government if they're so eager to destroy it or dismantle it or denigrate it, because there is certainly in this country, if not an anger, a disgust with the inaction and dysfunction of Washington. But a lot of that, and we can speak separately about the timidity of too many corporate establishment Democrats, is because the Republicans have decided they don't want government to work.
Right.
Now, government needs to be cleaned up. Government is full of metastasizing money. There are too many lobbyists, you know, last count, 7 lobbyists for every representative. But there is a role for government to work on behalf of the common good. And so that the fact that there's now this battle over executive orders and executive action, the nation did a special issue in January 2013 laying out 20 executive actions, orders the president could take, whether it was from taking Cuba off the terrorist list to the climate change action we've seen from the president to some of what I write about in this on Good Jobs Initiative. But I think, we of course spoke of the wariness we know through history of abuse of executive action. And this White House has abused, as have previous ones, whether it's through lack of transparency on drones, kill lists. But there is a role for wise use of executive action at a moment when the Republican House has decided it's not going to take any action on behalf of people. I mean, look at the immigration issue, on gun control, on a set of issues. And I think Americans want action on behalf of improving people's lives. So I felt that this was just one of the executive orders that could be lifted up that would improve the condition of millions of people's lives, also rebuild a middle class that has been under assault, largely because labor unions are under assault and shrinking. And you could use this executive action, this Good Jobs executive action, to put some 21 million Americans onto the road of joining the middle class, because the U.S. government is the largest employer of low-wage workers. It's a proposal. Hmm. I think the president is more in a mode to use executive orders because, sadly, I think the president waited a very long time to see more clearly what was going on in D.C. You know, he believed, maybe rightly, he was elected because he spoke of how red and blue America could come together. But I think confronting the obstructionism of the Republican Party has taken a long time, and people, sadly, to a large degree, have turned away from Congress and decided it is not going to work on their behalf. I think executive orders could move things through and show that government could work on behalf of people's common good.
I think we're in a very interesting and tricky place in this country when it comes to what steps to take next, both electorally and just politically and in terms of activism. given the elections coming up and all the other things we're facing. And when I look at the conversations we've had with people on the border of the United States right now, and I've talked to both conservatives who want to send these kids back without thinking about it twice, to people who are active in trying to work with people in the deserts, that we have a crisis here that even the United Nations Committee on Refugees, Commission on Refugees, has said could be an international humanitarian crisis with almost 50,000 children coming alone and be at the border. And we don't know how many more actually got through or how many more are coming, but 50,000 now in the custody of the United States of America. And President Barack Obama, of course, saying $3 billion, he wants $3 billion to address this. One of our guests questioned the other day, what would that be spent for, to speed it up and send them back or to really address the issue? And so this is the question here again, where progressives may be going against some of the tide because people are terrified of the issue of undocumented people. Many Americans are, not all Americans, many Americans are, and how we should respond to all of this.
You know, it is a deep conversation, Mark, and it's hard to sit back and talk history when we have this immediate humanitarian crisis.
But it's connected.
But yes, and history is important. We have Oscar Martinez, who wrote a very important book called The Beast a few years ago about the struggle of migrant workers to come to this country. But what we're looking at now is a history of U.S. policy toward these countries, not solely U.S. policy. It's also indigenous policy, but in Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, but U.S. complicity with the drug war, which has contributed to narco cartels, U.S. complicity in trade agreements, which have destroyed these countries' economies. So I think that has to be paid attention to. That has to be paid attention to because it's the root cause. At the same time, how do you deal with the immediate humanitarian crisis? I fear that too much of the money, much of it is going to go toward deportation. Now, if there's a way to bring some of that funding to bear where kids could be integrated into this country and some of that money goes to addressing some of the causes of this crisis in home countries, it would be far better used. The politics of this immigration debate, as you know, we were talking earlier about Iraq and the constant calls for military action when crises occur. I would draw a parallel between that and the immigration crisis. Too often, militarized approaches are the first on the agenda, and they drive a debate. They drive policy, which demands alternative approaches. It's a fraught crisis. And, of course, you know, the Republicans are blaming Obama's policy on the Dreamers.
Right.
And that is driving politics, too. So the root causes don't get enough attention. The fact that, you know, this is maybe too partisan, but that George W. signed this trafficking legislation, which is playing a role in this crisis. But the broader thing is to avoid militarization of approaches to crises, whether it is Iraq, whether it is immigration. Your guest, I'm sure, had many wise things to say. How these ideas can be heard, I do think because of the demographic shifts in this country and the growing strength of the Latino community, there's a possibility that it can play electorally, which will drive politicians to some sanity. The fact that Latinos are not voting in numbers they might be in the context of their demographic percentages is an issue which, I mean, I don't think it's that hard. I don't think people see Latino community or others often see much reason to vote because they're not seeing improvement again in the condition of their lives. But the voting will become important because that's where pressure can be brought to bear in addition to movements and activism.
Now, I'm curious as we conclude, Katrina, that's something I've been thinking about. I've been reading The Nation, I guess, for many, many years. I mean, since the early 60s on. And I think about how the demographic has changed, how our politics, the political struggles and efforts in America have changed, the social struggles have changed in America. We're into the 21st century, and not just in terms of technology, but in terms of the role media can play, the role that The Nation can now play in thinking about what is happening this century. How do you see The Nation fitting in? What do you see the changes are The Nation has to make to continue its relevance? Not saying it's not relevant.
No, of course. I mean, there's no question continuity and change has to be a hallmark of our work. I mean, we are marking our 150th birthday
right.
next year. You know, part of it, we continue to believe that quality journalism, sort of the news, reflection, debate, strategic thinking for progressives in the 21st century, you know, but constantly renewing a tradition is important. Of course, you know, thenation.com, we're investing in new ways of moving our journalism to readers. But I think we stay true to the idea that there's an engaged, passionate coverage of social movements that has helped, I think, progressives to see ourselves as connected across issue and geography, whether it's the Iraq War, the war on workers, the fight for immigration reform, marriage equality. I think The Nation, through its history and today, fosters a sense of community, sort of common endeavor among progressives. So I think that honest dialogue, the presentation of different views, independent thinking, coverage of social movements in ways that the mainstream just doesn't get. And above all, I hope with continuity and change that The Nation remains this, you know, beacon of hope, inspiration, and ideas that has nourished minds and spirits through the dark periods of our history. And I think, and I hope, positions us today to seize the moment as I believe the country once again opens up the challenge, but it's opening up to progressive, sane possibilities.
And I think you will. Katrina Vandenhoevel is a editor and publisher of The Nation, joined us here for this conversation about a number of things. And Katrina, thank you so much, and thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you, Mark.